Hello, and welcome to our special Creation Care episodes of Prophetic Voices, Preaching and Teaching Beloved Community, a podcast from the Episcopal Church's Office of Reconciliation, Justice, and Creation Care, where we explore the season and the lectionary through the lens of social justice. I'm your host, Reverend Shaniqua, Staff Officer for Racial Reconciliation, and I'm so glad you could join us. In this episode of Prophetic Voices, we'll be discussing the lectionary for Rogation Days 1. Our amazing guests this week are the Reverend Kerry Meyer, who is the founding priest and farmer at Good Courage Farm, an agrarian ministry affiliated with Episcopal Church in Minnesota. Prior to returning to her Midwestern roots in 2019, she served as associate rector at St. Gregory of Nyssa in San Francisco. The Reverend Glenna Huber, who is the 15th rector at Church of the Epiphany in Washington, D.C. She lives with her husband, two children, a dog, and lots of fish. And last, but not least, is Dr. David O'Hara, who is chair of the religion department at Augustana University in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where he also directs programs in philosophy, environmental studies, and sustainability. Welcome, friends. Thank you so much, everybody, for willing to share your wisdom and experience and be guests on this Rogation Sunday podcast. One of the things that I was wondering about is, why is it important for us to talk about Rogation Day, or what does Rogation Day mean to you?
Since picking up the vocation of farming 4 years ago, I am so much more aware in my body and my mind and my heart of how I rely on the goodness of God through the providence that is the created world. And I think we get a little separated from that in the food economy in which we're all embedded. We can run to the store, we can get DoorDash, and the snack or the meal that we are hungry for kind of shows up. But that's not the whole truth. The whole truth is that there are so many lives and so much labor and so many interdependent relationships between living and non-living things, all of which have been designed so beautifully and elegantly by God. If we take a moment to acknowledge that, then our sense of mutual responsibility and the depth of our gratitude, it just expands. So I think that to take a moment to acknowledge how absolutely reliant we are on the goodness of God's open hand through which we are all filled, I think it's just one of the finest Sundays of our liturgical year.
Kerry puts that really nicely. I think about not a very spiritual source, but Aldo Leopold wrote in his Sand County Almanac, there are two spiritual dangers in not owning a farm. One is you think that your heat comes from the furnace, and the other is that you think that your food comes from the grocery store. It also kind of puts me in mind of something that St. Paul said when he was in Athens in Acts 17. He's quoting Epimenides, the Greek poet, when he says, in God we live and move and have our being. Those two together, Paul in Athens and Aldo Leopold writing from Wisconsin, I think both of them are reminding us that it is in God that we live and move and have our being. It's in God that we have our sustenance. And it's really easy for us to forget and to start thinking that all that we have and all that we need comes actually from our own hard work or our own savings account, our own attempt to provide for ourselves. If nothing else, Rogation Sunday is a reminder that it's God who provides for us.
I think in America, we function as we are independent. David just supports what you say, that sometimes we forget that we are really reliant upon not just God, which is sometimes hard for folks to fully grasp, but each other and the earth that God has provided. If we don't work together well, earth, divine, and people, then it doesn't work well.
Yeah.
I'm curious, like, what kind of liturgical ideas you have for Rogation Sunday? I think at one of my churches, we used to go out after church and we'd go out on the lawn and sing, and then we'd bless seeds and pass out packets of seeds to people. I heard way back in the day, they used to take a little kid and like tip him upside down and bop their head on the corner of each of the property lines as they'd walk around. I've threatened to do that a few times as a joke. And then I had a couple of kids at the church I worked at being like, oh yeah, we want to get bopped on the head on the plate. And I was like, well, I was joking. That's probably not safe church. And then other people, I think they actually have a whole worship service. What kind of ideas do you have for this?
To lift up the work of Pastor Christian Mueller Lilly and Deacon Don Lynn Greeney, who are co-conspirators here at Good Courage Farm, because they put a lot of imagination and a lot of connection building into making Rogation happen last year. It was our first year of observing Rogation Tide here at Good Courage. We had folks come to the farm and both bring seeds for their own garden, but also come and bless the fields and the crops and the animals here on the farm. And we did it full on Anglican, you know, smells, bells. I mean, I had a thurible. We blessed the water, and the deacons had processional crosses and the gospel book. And I mean, and we were vested, and it was such a unique experience. It was really embodied and tapped into, you know, deep traditions of the church in England. We had a great time. We prayed psalms in our silo, which is where we usually worship here on the farm. And we sang hymns as we walked through the green fields. Thank goodness this is like the one feast, because it's in May when Rogation Sunday is usually, it's actually nice here. So it was green and beautiful. And you could actually, the images in the Psalms and the images in the gospel that we read were unfolding around us. So there was this material experience of the goodness that we were receiving and the blessing that we were asking for. At Pastor Christian's request, we took it on the road. So for the next couple of days, on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday of Rogationtide, we went to our neighbor farms, and we brought the whole kit, and we brought our friends and our neighbors, and we blessed their hoop houses, and we anointed the farm workers' hands with oil. And it was so incredibly sacramental. And I mean that in like the deepest sense of that word, about all of these material outward signs of what God is doing in creation and how God's grace is something that we can taste and see. And then we went to our neighbor's vineyard. The children of the family that owns the vineyard were so enthralled with the idea of water that we had blessed. And it's been a drought here, and they were enthusiastically asperging all of the vines at the vineyard there.
Nice.
And this year we're going to go out to the co-op to go to the grain elevator to reach out to our neighbors who farm differently than we do here at Good Courage, and, you know, and are embedded in the economy of commodity crops grown conventionally. But they too are in deep dependent relationship with the land. And so we're going to go out, we're going to take the whole thing out to the co-ops and bless tractors and bless the soybeans, and hopefully meet some neighbors who I think would be so encouraged by the church's recognition of their work and the need for God's blessing and our interrelatedness.
At our camp and conference center, we've planted trees in the past. And did a full tree blessing with my kids. We start on Earth Day, but we plant seeds, and that has developed, I guess it's not really liturgical, but that's what we do in our household.
Nice.
Yes, Shaniqua, what you're talking about, it sounds like that old tradition of, what do they call it, beating the bounds or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm on a university campus. It's an urban university campus. We've got some green space. You know, our chapel doesn't really have any place for plantings, but we do have some gardens around campus. One of the things that I'll plan to do is to give students some seeds. And in particular, I'm going to give them some indigenous seeds. We plant a lot of stuff here in the Midwest that doesn't come from the Midwest, stuff that kind of reminds us of ancestral traditions from other countries or other parts of this country. And I want to give them some of the seeds that we've overlooked, some of the native seeds, and then encourage them to scatter them wherever the wind will. About a year ago, one of my students came to me. She'd missed class for a week, and she came to me, and it turns out that one of her very old friends had committed suicide in a pretty horrible way. She's one of those people who has kind of wrestled through a variety of religious traditions and never found rest in any of them. I wasn't really sure quite what to do for her, but I knew that she was struggling. I asked her if she wanted to meet me in one of the gardens and scatter some seeds. She asked, are there any rules? I said, nope. I brought with me just a big gallon of seeds that I had gathered. And she said, what do I do? And I said, take some seeds. So she reached her hand in and grabbed a fistful. She's like, this many? I said, yep, that's the right amount. Now what do I do? And I said, just throw them in the air. She said, that's it. And I said, well, if you want, you can say whoosh as well. She went, whoosh. And then she said, now what? And I said, you can do it again if you want to. So several more times she just went, whoosh, whoosh. And that was all. That was the whole liturgy, if you will. What was especially nice was over the coming months, those seeds started to blossom. And then I went back and harvested the seeds. And now I have a jar on my desk of the seeds from the plants that she planted. And last time I saw her, I said, you need to stop by my office. I have something for you. These traditions we're talking about, whether we're planting something, if we have the space to plant it, or beating the bounds, whatever the bounds might be like, hopefully not actually beating any children. Whatever we do, I think we can do those little things that will remind us that our provision comes from God. And sometimes all we've got to do is just sort of say whoosh and scatter some seeds where they'll go.
That's so very beautiful, that image.
It felt pretty good too.
As a rural priest, I think it's such a beautiful occasion to say to my neighbors who farm for a living, yours is holy work. It's acknowledged in the life of the church, and that you are co-laborers with the Holy Spirit in the greening of the world. And so I think that to sort of elevate the vocation of farmers everywhere in the community where I live is a wonderful reason to celebrate Rogation. But then also, I think too, I was thinking when you were speaking of the losses in our community to death by suicide, suicide among farmers is a real thing. To make space in our liturgical life to acknowledge the powerlessness that the people who feed our communities face, the unjust economic systems of late stage capitalism, and by the unraveling of our climate and our ecologies, to have a liturgy in which we can both lament and also just remember that all of this is actually placed in the hands of God who created the universe. And that even when our work fails as farmers, ultimately God is still holding provident. And so I think that Rogation can maybe give people a space to acknowledge that and to rekindle some hope in the face of what is a really, really hard job.
In Watertown, where I worked when I first got my first job as a priest, the farmers, like when it came time to harvest in the fall, maybe we'll talk about this later when we do the fall ones, but like they actually would like bring up their corn and they weigh all the corn, and then their like donation to the church is like a tenth of whatever the crop was that they came in. And so they actually record it that way, and it saves some tax stuff for the farm and for the corn people and for the church. It's kind of interesting. This idea of loss made me think about this Jeremiah passage when it was talking about drought. Where do you see real and maybe metaphorical droughts in our land?
We're coming off three growing seasons of severe drought in Minnesota. And it's funny how it can be an acute crisis, you know, like in a growing season, to not have the rain you need. It affects your everyday. But wow, after three seasons of not having enough, you start to see the withering the prophets and the psalmists use as metaphors for what it's like to try to be a living thing separated from what we need most. We've lost a lot of our perennial crops here due to the drought.
Thinking about in that Jeremiah passage, it talks about sending servants to the cisterns. I just came back from teaching in several dry countries, of teaching about water and religion in Morocco and Spain and Greece. We see cisterns in a lot of places, but the cisterns, they're what you turn to when your wells are dry and when your rivers are dry. That's your backup plan. You know, the cistern is for catching rainwater off of your temple roof or off of your barn roof, but it's not good water. It's stale water. So when you go to your cistern and your cistern is dry, that's when your backup plan has failed. You know, you've known about the problem for a long time at that point, and you've been watching it dwindle down. It's interesting, too, to see every culture, even ancient cultures, have cisterns. It's an old thing. We know that water is life, right? So, Shaniqua, your question, where do we see drought? Obviously, we're seeing drought in water around the world. I think in our country and in our culture, we're feeling some of those ways, too, where our backup plans are failing. We felt like we could coast for a long time on our feeling of community, or we could coast for a long time on systems that maybe we didn't do a whole lot to back up. Cultural habits where we thought, everything's fine, I don't have to worry, I can just get along and ignore the fact that I see cracks appearing in the ground where it's drying out elsewhere because there's still water in the cistern. I think there's a lot of pressure on all of us to do things like save up money for ourselves in hopes that the money will somehow be enough for us. And when we're doing that, I think we often forget how hard it is for so many members of our community to save up money from day to day. When we feel a little bit of a pinch in our friendships and our families, it can be easy to forget that that's a lifelong crisis for many people in our communities as well. We're facing a crisis of fresh water everywhere. And it's interesting, you know, 70% of the planet is covered with water, but of that 70%, only 3% is fresh water. And of that 3% of 70%, I don't know the exact numbers, but a great proportion of it is now impaired. I think about some of those passages in the Revelation of St. John that I used to dismiss as being silly when I was younger, about the oceans turning to wormwood or stars falling from heaven. And I was like, you know, it seemed like a comic book or something. And then I look at the state of our oceans and the state of our rivers, and I think, oh, this is just describing the things that we ourselves are actually doing to the place where we live.
So I'm in an urban landscape. You know, if you're talking about the impact of drought, you know, we didn't see any snow this year. I live in Maryland, work in D.C. There's no snow. So I know what that means. If there's no snow, there's no water. If there's no water, all of those crops in Western Maryland, all of those farms in Western Maryland will not be able to produce in the ways that they produce, which impacts the pocketbooks of those who live in D.C. You know, earlier this year, we had the egg issue because of the avian flu. So I walked into the grocery store and there were no eggs. And there was a woman just standing in front of the empty egg case. She just stood there and I looked at her and she said, well, I've never seen this. There are no eggs. And I was like, yeah, there's going to be no corn. There's going to be no, I mean, when there's these real droughts, urban folks don't see it as much because our daily existence, we don't see the farm. We don't see where the crops are, but we do see it in the grocery stores. I would also say because of where I'm located, I see drought metaphorically in how we relate to each other. I mean, the terminology I've been using is unmitigated gun violence. The general apathy for the value of human life, that's systemic, that we just don't care enough about each other to make sure these guns are off the streets. There's no reason it should be this prolific. There's no reason that children should not be allowed to or not have access to the type of education that would allow them to live lives that are fulfilled so they don't have to go out and shoot each other, right? That's where I see drought. And I like the Romans passage. You know, it's just a beautiful allegory of the whole world groaning in labor pains. But you can't plant where in the midst of a drought. And so we can't get to the labor pains because we can't plant the seeds. It's just so much dry land right now. And I am looking for that space where there is some water so that we can begin to tend to the abundance that God has for us.
I was thinking similarly about a drought of humanity or community or a drought of sharing. Then I think too, just like you said, there might be no eggs and no corn, and then it will impact other things and our interconnectedness. Like I think the drought that we have of our recognizing humanity or the prolificness of racism and the systemicness of it, that will impact others, and folks might be drawing on the cisterns to try and figure out how to fix that. And the solutions we had before, which may have been very inappropriate, then aren't working. And so now they're trying to do other things, and maybe we have to come back to this. How are we going to be like water? How can we become like water? Glenna, you brought up Romans. I was very curious about this idea. Like, it feels very predestination-y to me when it talks about creation was subjected to futility, not of its own, which is kind of contradictory to, as a Lakota person, you know, we see like creation as having its own autonomy and rocks and plants and things being our siblings. What would creation having freedom of the glory of the children of God look like? Or what do you think about that idea of the creation not having autonomy?
Shaniqua, there's some tension in that. We talk about humans having autonomy, yet at the same time, we are totally dependent on God. How do we reconcile that tension? And I haven't figured it out yet. I mean, I don't see why Earth would be any different having been created by the same.
The last couple of years, I've been thinking about this idea of swords being beaten into plowshares. That's another one of those passages that I've had to rethink. It used to sound to me like a prophecy of eventual peace. You know, the more we do no-till farming and the more appropriate it is for us to do no-till farming, I'm reminded, yeah, actually turning the swords into plowshares is just a different kind of violence where we're trying to force the creation to produce for us. What would it be like to live in such a relationship with creation that we didn't feel like we needed to beat it in order to make it produce food for us? We humans now outweigh all of the wild mammals on the planet, put together, and our livestock outweighs them by even more, which means we've kind of shoved aside all sorts of wildlife and wild spaces in order to produce just a few things that we want a lot of. Now, I wondered, well, I mean, it seems obvious when you got 8 billion people on the planet, if you just gave up agriculture right now and you gave up animal husbandry right now, we'd probably all starve, at least from a practical standpoint. It would take a miracle for us not to at this point. I think that might be what you're asking about, isn't it? Wouldn't it be wonderful to imagine a way in which we could be in relationship to all that God has made, that we were caring for all that God has made, and all that God has made is caring for us, and we're not in conflict with one another? I feel like a dreamer saying that, but it feels like a good dream.
One of the things that it talks about is waiting for us to be adopted. It says, for in hope we are saved. And I think this image in Romans really kind of calls us as Christians, or as people of, as the body of Christ, or as people in general, to work with and support and free, in a way, free creation. What does it mean to be adopted, and how is that related to our role in freeing creation?
I took our family to Hawaii last summer, and we were there all of August. You know, there was fruit falling off the trees. We weren't staying in the tourist spaces, but we stayed out in the outskirts. So we were living as regular Hawaiians for the month in a rectory, and our water bin had a leak, and so we had no water for some time, and it wasn't raining, so we didn't have enough. We had to figure out how to deal with our water and just really be dependent on nature in a way that my family has not had to do ever. And just to be okay with that, it does feel very utopian. For the long haul, I don't know that that would work, but just seeing fruit growing off the trees and the fishermen when they come in and getting the fish, like just working with the earth to feed ourselves and to bathe ourselves and to get fluid. It's very different. It slows us down, which I hadn't experienced in some time. I don't know if we're ready for that.
Glenna, what you say about slowing us down seems really important, because you're talking about our relationship, not just with nature, but our relationship with time, aren't you?
Right, because you got to wait for stuff to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So like the dragon fruit, which, by the way, is $5 a pound here. But the dragon fruit was just on the trees, but there's just a moment when it's ready. One of the parishioners at the church said, you just have to watch it, because if you miss that moment, it's no good to eat. I was like, sweet, I'm going to sit there under that tree and wait.
That moment, too, which we experience here on the farm, because it's mostly a fruit farm where we're at, that moment that you're describing, Glenna, is also that extraordinary moment of transformation when the thing that I had been tending, the thing that I had been nurturing, suddenly in this miraculous, like, twinkling of an eye, becomes the thing that now gives me life. And suddenly, like, our places in the gift economy just swap, right? Because I may have been nurturing that grapevine, and I have been tending those clusters of grapes, and I've been like clipping away the leaves so that they get more sun and that so that the sugar increases. And I'm the one giving and giving to that living thing. And then suddenly, when the moment is right, it becomes a gift for me. And it becomes goodness and sweetness and food. That relationship of reciprocity and that moment that you're describing, Glenna, I think is just part of the power of being in relationship with the food and the land that sustains us.
Carrie, you talk about that in terms of gift, and I think that's a brilliant way to think about it. I recently came back from teaching in the Mediterranean. Some folks have a little plot of land in the mainland in Greece, in a little valley. And they've got an orange grove, an organic orange grove. And I love it when I can take my students there, because my students have never been any place like this, of course. But I also know that the owners, I know their character. And every time we go there, I'll show up with 10 students, and the owners will say, this is our orange grove. And the students go, wow, this is really cool. And then Petros, the father, will always say, go and pick some. Mm-hmm. And the students are like, wait, you mean you can just pick it off the tree? And he'll just grab one from right nearby and split it open and say, here, have some. And then he'll grab another and starts throwing them to the students. And they always have more oranges than they can hold or what they know what to do with. And they have that sense of superabundance, of entering into a gift. Mm. And they're the same oranges that we could have bought a mile away in the market. The difference is that they're right there at the trees. The man who has cultivated these trees and cared for them has just given them away to the students, and the trees are giving them away to the students. There's something marvelous about being in that kind of gifting relationship, isn't mm-hmm. there?
I'm thinking about that question about adoption and how that idea, that hope and possibility can shape our relationship with creation. And I think about all of the families that I know and love who have become family through adoption. It is not the genetic material of their embodiment that makes them family to one another, right? They need not look like one another to love one another fiercely and deeply as family. And I think that our awareness of that possibility in the human story makes it a little bit easier for us to make the leap and say, how can I be kin to the red-tailed hawk and to the salamanders in my hoop house? We are not genetically even like close, and yet we are kin. That idea of kinship with one another and with Christ is adoptive by nature, by its essence. I really think that that can expand our sense of family to include all of creation. Glenna, in response to the first question, you named interdependence as one of the things that we can get in touch with through observation. And you were talking about the story about the eggs, and it made me think it's so true what you said about interdependence. And then you were talking about being confronted with an empty case where the eggs should have been. Here on our farm, we're actually not going to have apples this year, and for the same exact reason. The avian influenza outbreak in Minnesota, it hurt our raptor population. It hit them really hard. And so our red-tailed hawks and our barred owls have suffered, and their numbers are down, which means that in combination with the extraordinary snowfall that we have a rabbit population like no farmers here have ever seen. It's almost like biblical, right? Like if God had sent bunny rabbits to the farms of West Central Minnesota, we've lost more than 300 apple trees.
Wow.
And because of the interdependent web of creation, the same thing that made that empty egg case is going to make empty bushel baskets for our apples this year. And to encounter that, you know, to physically stand in front of an empty egg case and to stand out in an orchard where all of the trees have been killed by other creatures, I think it opens our heart to the possibility that all of this, everything that we suffer, everything that we need is just woven so finely.
Carrie, my heart is aching as you say this, because on campus, I lost just about every single one of my fruit trees this year for just the same reasons.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dave.
You know how it is. We'll try to figure it out.
Yeah.
But all of our students who are brewing minors no longer have apples to work with. And so just as you're saying, what affected the eggs is now affecting their cider. That's going to have a ripple effect on everything else that they would have been doing in their food and fermentation classes. Mm-hmm. Everything's connected to everything else.
Yeah.
And maybe that's an answer to Shaniqua's initial question. Why should we even think about Rogation Sunday in our churches? It's a reminder. Everything is connected to everything else. Everyone is connected to everyone else. That interdependence that Glenna was talking about.
I'm going to skip around and go back to Jeremiah. But in Jeremiah, it says in his prophecy that the Lord is in the midst of us, even in our droughts and desperation. And where do you see the Lord in the midst of our suffering right now? When the price of eggs skyrocketed, it actually was cheaper to go drive out to the colonies, which we have a lot of like Mennonite and Hutterite colonies that have their own chickens, and go get eggs from them, which were normally more expensive than the ones in the store. And so what I noticed then is that meant that people who hadn't done that before went out there probably to save money, but they also went out there. That meant they were building connections and relationships with people, right? And in relationships, we can find the sacred. And so I think that was maybe a way that we could find Christ in that moment of a drought.
You ask, where do we see the Lord in the midst of our suffering? And I feel like most of the suffering that I experience and that my students and I experience is pretty small. We're also feeling the real abundance of being able to travel again, to study abroad again after several years of not studying abroad during COVID, for instance. And on our campus, one of the things, we're a Lutheran campus, one of the things that this reminded us of is that whenever we travel, that luxury that we have comes at others' cost. And so this year on our campus, we've decided that every time we travel, we're going to take part of the cost of the travel and use it to help to restore some of the rainforest of our indigenous partners in Guatemala, which they're fighting to preserve right now. The more of it they can preserve, the more carbon that gets sequestered and so on. There's probably a lot of other things like that that we can do. Our own individual suffering can really become quite big in our own minds. When our own suffering becomes a reminder to care and to act on others' behalf, I think a lot of opportunities come to us to share the abundance that we have right now, even if it doesn't feel all that abundant. I mean, aren't there so many stories in scripture like this where somebody says, I have no more food, or I have just a little bit more to go. And somebody else says, well, consider sharing it. We all know the stories. There's always more than they think they have. More loaves and fishes, more oil in the jar, more flour to be baked into bread and so on. In answer to your question, where do I see the Lord in our suffering? I see that the Lord is giving us opportunities to care.
And I think the Lord suffers with us too, right? Mm-hmm. They don't know this, but this Sunday we're recording is the, you know, raising of Lazarus. The Lord suffered when Lazarus was suffering too. He was there present with the family, and that was his friend.
Mm-hmm. I believe it's in Romans where it says when one part of the body suffers, the whole body suffers. And if one part of the body rejoices, the whole body rejoices. When I talk about adoption, I work with a group of kids during the summers, and very few of them live with their biological families. And so we talk about adoption a lot. In some circles, adoption is a great thing. For those who are adopted, the reality is far more nuanced. And so my role is to help these young people embrace who they are because of adoption. And I do talk about being adopted into God's family and what that looks like. To be adopted into the household of God, to be adopted into the body of Christ, means that my suffering, or what I understand my suffering to be, doesn't take precedence over your suffering. The water crisis, which is still ongoing in Flint, Michigan, which is still ongoing in South Africa, that crisis is my crisis. One of my children enjoys singing in the shower and the whole experience of the shower. And I'm like, look, you can't, because as abundant as water is, it is finite as well. And so we've got to be considerate of how we're using water. Our siblings in South Africa are not able to take showers the same way we are because we're using too much. Just being cognizant that we're not the only ones. There's drought here, but there's also in California what was drought, but now is too much water. But if we're paying attention, then we can see the face of God and figure out how God is asking us to be with each other so that we can support each other through the crisis.
You got me thinking, Glenna, about that word adopt in a way I've never thought about before, and the opt part in particular of adopt. It's from this Latin verb meaning to choose. We've got people in front of us, whether directly in front of us or as you were talking about people who are in front of us, but perhaps geographically far away. How will we choose to be their neighbors? We are adopted. Whom do we adopt as well?
So I'm going to shift us over to the gospel so we can talk about that, because I'm sure that's probably the thing that a lot of people will preach on. There's two different parables in here. There's the, you know, scattering the seed and harvesting the grain, and then the mustard seed one. How does our current understanding of botany or horticulture impact the reading of this passage now?
It is, I think, fair to say scientifically that we still do not know how it grows.
Wow.
I mean, we know a lot about the process, but there is a depth of mystery still in the how. But my favorite thing about seeds is both what it takes for a seed to germinate and how incredibly diverse germination is, right? I mean, we live in a cold climate here. And so most of the things that grow here in Minnesota require cold stratification. That is to say that a seed cannot actually sprout unless it gets cold. The cells in the wall of the seed have to get like cold and wet and freeze and crack, and then the process can start. But never fear, because not everything needs to be cold stratified. There are seeds out there that have to, of course, we know, be altered by fire in order for their seed coat to break down. But also, I mean, there are crazy things out there. Like, there are seeds in the desert that can only germinate if they've been scarified by blowing in a hot wind across rough sand.
Wow.
I mean, all of this is to say that to be a seed is rough work. That is some rough work, right? Because you are either going to have to freeze and crack, or you are going to have to burn, or you are going to have to travel literally across the wilderness and be beaten in order to become the thing that you are, in order to be the next thing. But there's still more depth to the how of what does water do with those enzymes and how does it really know when? And seeds can know so much. Seeds can feel gravity. Seeds can see light. Seeds can smell smoke.
Wow.
The not knowing how, but still like really digging into that experience of what is it to be a seed, and then to send out a root and a stalk and the leaves. Ooh, there's so much there. People are lucky I don't get to preach on that every single Sunday, because I would just again and again and again.
It's almost like Carrie saying that biblical commentary section on your shelf, just shove that aside and get Suzanne Simard's Finding the Mother Tree and Robin Wall Kimmerer's Breeding Sweetgrass. Just put those in there and maybe pull those out and then see what they say about seeds and how plants communicate. And maybe that'll help.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. We know so little about how anything grows. It's so marvelous that we get to participate in it. I suppose, I mean, isn't that a little bit what it's like to be a pastor as well? Like, what on earth is making these people grow, making them grow to be more like God and to mature in their faith? And what's our role in that? It feels like we get to be apprentices in a workshop. Despite years of training and experience, we're still just watching the master at work and wondering, how on earth is that being shaped so wonderfully?
And I might ask those who are listening to my voice on that day, imagine yourself in this story, since we're not in farmland, right? Like, are you the seed or are you the one who scatters the seed? We don't know how we're growing, really, right? Mm-hmm. We'd like to think we do. Again, it comes back to being dependent, because we think we are in charge. And then it turns out we're just as mysterious as the seed.
Carrie, as you were talking, I was thinking about all of the things that I have been through and some of the people I know, like the struggles they've been through and how like that's the seed. Like maybe I don't know what's going to grow from them, but that they could grow. I'm just thinking of all these sermons I could preach from just what you said. Mm-hmm. How often do we think of ourselves as the hot sun in the desert that's scarifying those seeds? And maybe that's not what we should be doing, right? That could be sinful, right? Or what are, you know, like thinking, I was just thinking about some of that stuff, or some of like, doesn't make up for the racism that caused it, but like some of the amazing spirituals that came out of the pain and suffering of slavery, or some of the deep stuff that we have in indigenous culture, some of the stories that we have that came out of deep suffering.
I am not a fan of any theology that like touches on, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, all of that. It is so unhelpful more often than not. But if that is what happens to seeds, if they have to undergo just trials to become the next thing, that if God has growth in store, then I can make meaning of my struggles and my suffering. I'd rather other people didn't make meaning for other people's struggles and suffering.
Amen. Amen.
Maybe this can be something that we can know about creation that can help us make meaning.
What do you find important about the parable of the mustard seed? Like, I used to focus on like how big it got or whatever. Sometimes I focused not on that, but on like the things that it does. What stands out for you in that parable?
I'll tell you what stands out for me, and this might not be relevant to anybody else, but as I've been trying to restore a little patch of prairie, you know, we've lost 99% of our tall grass prairie, something like that. And I've been trying to restore just a tiny little, like a 40th of an acre of it. And the one thing that I can't seem to get rid of is mustard. There's this invasive mustard plant. You get one seed in there, and the next year you will have 100,000 seeds in there, because those things, they just produce so many seeds, and I can't seem to stop them all. But they're also really beautiful when they blossom, and the bees love them. I find myself having this kind of love-hate relationship with the mustard. I think it's probably helping the soil in some good ways. It's certainly helping the pollinators in some good ways. But I also want some of my native prairie plants to grow there.
My favorite thing about that parable is that the outcome, it's not for us. The net result is birds nested in it. It's not for you. It's actually for someone else. And I kind of love that decentering of humans as actors and recipients in that story. I love every translation that calls it the greatest of shrubs. Because I'm just like, is that a category that you want to be the greatest of? Like, and I just really dig that.
I think about it in terms of justice work or the ministry that I do around justice issues. I moved from Atlanta from a corporate size congregation to Park Heights. It maxed out at 60 people. But the Park Heights neighborhood was devastated in ways that I had never experienced consistently. The prevalence of drug abuse, gun violence, underemployment, undereducation, just the decimation of family, the divestment of public services. It was systemically set up to perpetuate generational poverty and carry over that trauma. Not only you could see it, but people were carrying it in their being. And I was not fully prepared to lead as a spiritual presence in that environment. And for the first year, I was really overwhelmed because I was like, oh my gosh, I'm coming in with so much privilege. I have so much responsibility. That was something I had grown up understanding. You have privilege, and because you have privilege, you have responsibility. And I did not know, I couldn't attend to all of the needs that I could just see in front of me. There's something that Bishop Desmond Tutu used to say, do your little bit of good where you are, and that little bit of good is going to change the world. And I was like, okay, I'm going to be this mustard seed. I'm going to be the best little bit of good that I am able to be, and I'm going to be okay with that. It took years of systemic devaluation of humanity to get to where we are. It may not change the way I know that God dreams for it to be in my lifetime. But that does not mean that I can't do my little bit of good where I am and encourage and inspire others to do the same.
Right.
If I look at the Right Reverend Barbara Harris, who died in 2020 around this week, and she really was a small woman in stature. So I could call her the greatest of shrubbery. There are so many who are able to be who we are being because of all the branches that she spread throughout the communion. I hope I can do the same. And I hope I can inspire others to be courageous enough to do the same.
So Glenna, you just said this amazing thing about how Barbara Harris was kind of like put forth branches for a lot of other folks. And how might we put forth branches so that others can make nests in our shade?
It's as basic as doing your little bit of good where you are.
One of the things I notice in the parable is something that's not said. The mustard seed does not grow into a shrub that it tells the birds what kind of nest to make. It's there. It's a resource. The birds get to choose. That's been a hard thing for me to learn, but I think it's a helpful thing for us to try to practice.
I used to live in Michigan near Houghton Lake. There's an endangered species of bird there called Kirtland's warbler. And I was thinking that, well, maybe we are the shrub and that we can provide the shade. But I was thinking about all of the benevolent biologist arsonists that burn all of the land in an area around Houghton Lake, because it turns out that Kirtland's warbler only nests in the branches of young jack pines, not old jack pines, but young jack pines. So they have to have just grown up in recent years. And the only way that jack pines will germinate, this goes back to the seed thing, is if there's been a fire.
Wow.
And so I've been thinking about, like, what does it mean to have to like burn things in order to grow things, in order to house and nurture things? Like, what if the work is that complex and that long?
And you know, it's easier to burn things when there's been a drought.
Yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
think of that as a metaphor of like racism, like what things might need to burn, right? Like there's a lot of things in our church and our systems that have white supremacy and white nationalism and you know, all of that, Christian nationalism, that I could see needing to burn so other things could grow.
We might even take our whole notion of church and let that burn so that we can really come to something that's life-giving moving forward. Maybe. I don't want to be blasphemous.
No, I love it. I love it.
I think COVID did some of that for us too, helped us really kind of come down to the nitty-gritty of what kind of what matters and what doesn't. I was thinking about branches as like capacity building.
Mm.
How are we building capacity for folks? I think one of my, well, I'll use the example of my diocese here in South Dakota, right? We're about 60 to 70% folks of color in the diocese. Almost all the diocesan staff are white. Our bishop, everybody except for archdeacon is white. You know, they'll look for Native people or folks of color, but we don't pay very well, so people don't apply. And anyway, I'm like, how are we building capacity then? If, you know, fine, we have all white staff or whatever. How are we building capacity in our Native communities and raising up folks, making space for them so that they can grow and learn and become whatever it is, priests or administrators, whatever they can do, so that maybe our diocesan office at some point will have a Native bishop or won't have an all-white staff or whatever.
One of the most important things that I think a leader can do along those lines is succession planning. Mm. And so, you know, I think about myself as a tenured professor. I'm one of those white leaders in South Dakota. What you're calling for, I think appropriately, is for me to not only hope to have somebody else take the position that I have, but to do the work of cultivating and preparing for that to happen.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking too about, you know, rethinking our notion of church. I think we can do that in so many different ways. There are so many ways that we have brought culture into church that isn't biblical. It's not necessarily bad, for instance, to have a lawn at our church, but what's that lawn doing?
Mm.
There's a way in which the lawn was put there as a way of inviting people in, people who, like us, like Kentucky bluegrass outside of a church. My students have been consulting with a lot of local churches and saying, if you want people inside eating bread and wine, maybe what you should be doing first is killing your lawn and growing food outside and making it free to anybody who needs it, and let them see, taste and see that the Lord is good outside of the church first.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Maybe eventually they'll want to come inside as well. And it might be at some point you just want to take down that building too and start growing some food where that building was. There was a story, I think it was in the New York Times. It was one of those lawsuits about the indigenous boarding schools where Native Americans and First Nations students were taken away from their families. The bishop was asked, you know, this lawsuit's going to cost you potentially everything. You might have to sell your churches. And what really struck me about this was the bishop saying, if we were to sell everything we have and to give up all the money that comes from that, and if that were to provide even a little bit of healing, wouldn't that be worth it?
Mm.
Because in the end, the church doesn't need a building. The church doesn't need any fineries. All we really need is a table, a cup, and some books. And in the end, do we even need that? I haven't heard nearly enough bishops say that sort of thing, or college presidents or others. You know, we inherit these fine institutions, and then we start to think about the finery of the institutions and forget what the institutions are there for. Maybe sometimes we need to, just like Carrie was saying, let those things burn so that new growth can come up and the warblers can sing. This is not the kind of talk any vestry wants to hear.
Right, right. Not that this makes it okay. David, you're the layperson of the group. So I love that you can say that. Like, we can say that too, but there could be some repercussions. But people do say that. And I definitely think our church needs to change. We have a lot of change to do. What tips do you have for preaching Rogation Sunday or Rogation Day?
I would just say bring the material into the encounter.
Hmm.
This is one of those Sundays, I think, when to preach to the 8 and 9-year-olds in our congregation, to bring them a sensory encounter with seed and soil and food in our preaching. I don't think we can go wrong with object lessons.
One of the resolutions passed at the convention was about planting trees. I want to combine the tree planting with some eco-justice conversation.
Mm.
We've been talking about ecological devastation and the impact already marginalized communities. And so we're going to look at that from the perspective of right here in D.C., in Southeast D.C., the air pollutants that are disproportionately located in already poor communities, and how our tree planting specifically in those spaces can begin the process of clearing the air, while at the same time we write to our elected officials so that they know that we're paying attention to where things are being planted. We will use our leverage to help around that, and that is gospel work.
Yes. Preach the gospel at all times. Use words if necessary.
Speaking as the layperson among us, as the teacher, I'll say that I am seeing larger and larger numbers of students wanting to learn about the environment. And I think it's because they recognize that they're going to have to live with the consequences of decisions that are made in their lifetime. And those of us who are older can easily forget that. I would say preach good news and bad news together. Make sure you're specific about both. The young people probably already know the bad news. I think the old people need to hear it. The young people really need to hear the good news because they need hope. One really simple way that we can do that, in combination with, I think, the wonderful things that Lena and Carrie have just spoken about, is give thanks specifically. We give thanks all the time, but I think it's helpful for us to remember to give thanks for our food, to remember that our food is daily a gift. Give us this day our daily bread. This is something quite remarkable that we have it from day to day, and we should not treat it as just a commodity, as just as something that we get at the grocery store, but something that has been given to us for our sustenance. And our sustenance now makes us branches in which other birds make their nests. Let's give thanks for that.
I heard a call for you to write a meal blessing that involves that, making branches so others can build nests in our branches.
I'll make a note.
I would love to hear that. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your wisdom and your experience and all of these beautiful stories and thoughts today. I really appreciate it. And so do our listeners.
Thank you.
Grateful for the conversation.
Thanks for having us.
If you want to learn more about Beloved Community, visit episcopalchurch.org/beloved-community. If you want to learn more about Creation Care, visit episcopalchurch.org/creation-care. Thanks to our guests, Carrie, Glenna, and David. Thanks also to our production team, especially Chris and Asma. If we planted a seed in your heart, please rate, review, and of course, share our podcast. Until next time, let your light shine.